I'd like to welcome back to the show Hampton Sides. He is a journalist, author, he's an editor at Outside Magazine, and he's author of several best-selling books, including Hellhound on His Trail and Blood and Thunder. His new book is called In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great to be back with you, Mayor Charlotte.
This is an amazing story because, of course, it's not just about this attempted voyage to the North Pole. It's also a chapter in post-Civil War American history, the history of journalism. How did you come across this story and this cast of characters?
Well, I was fascinated by the Gilded Age, this period after the Civil War when the United States was flexing its muscles and trying to figure out how to make a mark on the world stage. And polar exploration, Arctic exploration, was one of the ways to do it. There was this great fascination and almost obsession with what's up there at the North Pole. There are lots of theories about civilizations and holes at the poles. There was theories about the hollow earth, this hollow earth theory, this notion that if you get up there, you'll find that there's like people living inside the earth. And the most common theory that was around at that time was this notion of the open polar sea, the idea that there was a warm basin at the top of the world, and if you could just somehow smash through the ice, find a gateway, an easy way into that open polar sea, you'd have smooth sailing to the North Pole. So the Jeannette expedition was designed to test that theory. Obviously, we know now it was not just wrong, but ludicrously and dangerously wrong. This was an expedition to find out whether there really was an open polar sea. But, you know, as I set up the story, I became fascinated also with the people who sponsored this expedition. It was a U.S. Navy expedition, but the Navy at that time was quite anemic and quite in its infancy, and so they needed a sponsor, and they found this outrageous, outlandish, stupendously wealthy newspaper publisher named James Gordon Bennett Jr., who was the publisher of the New York Herald, one of the richest men in the world. He had sent Stanley to Africa to find Livingston.
And that was another one of the kind of obsessions that we had at that time. I mean, they were obsessed with the North Pole and they were obsessed with Africa.
Right. Well, you know, there were just a few places left on the face of the earth that had never been touched by man. And it drove people crazy not to know what was there, whether it was Africa, the tropics, parts of the outback of Australia. There was a handful of these places, and certainly the poles. Someone said it's like not knowing, it's like a man not knowing what his own attic looks like. It just drives you crazy, and you sit up at night obsessing about it. What does it look like? Well, we got to get there. And I think it's really difficult for us now, knowing what we do know, which is that there's really not much up there, for us to understand just how obsessed people were with this idea. Of course, the irony being that the climate change people are telling us that there will be likely an open polar sea, at least during summertime.
But of course, it's not caused by warm Arctic currents, which is what they had speculated.
Right. There were, I go into some of the science at the time, and there were theories that the Gulf Stream and a corresponding stream in the current in the Pacific Ocean called the Kuroshio, that these two currents swept up north through the Arctic and converged at the North Pole in this kind of beautiful symmetry, this notion of the planet regulating its heat that way. Obviously, all wrong. And that's the thing, you know, it's like these expeditioners consulted all the cutting-edge science of their day, and it was all wrong, and they had to pay the price for it.
And the kind of Greek tragedy of it is that right after the Jeannette went on its voyage and was no longer able to be called back, the data really started coming in.
Yes. Just as they were going north, another vessel was going south, heading for Washington with all this mother load of data showing that this Kuroshio current wasn't very warm, it wasn't heading in the right direction, and it wasn't softening up the ice of the Arctic, creating this gateway that they had hoped for. So what happens is, of course, they get stuck in the ice, and just north of the Bering Strait, they get stuck in the ice and drift for 2 years. and about 1,000 miles, although it's in this constantly shifting erratic pattern. But they finally, you know, after 2 years, the enormous pressures of the ice cap crush the hull of the vessel, and it sinks to the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. So you got these 33 men and their dogs and their open boats, which they have to drag over the ice towards the nearest landmass, which is the central coast of Siberia, about 1,000 miles away. So this begins one of the great survival stories, really, of all time, and just an extraordinary story of adventure and of comradeship, basically, and getting there.
Tell us about the captain of this ship, George DeLong. He was an extraordinary character. He was a true leader. And when you think about the kinds of fighting and mutinies and things like that that could have happened, yeah, they didn't happen under him.
Right. I mean, if you look at the literature of Arctic exploration, it's littered with three main themes, the three banes of Arctic exploration: mutiny, scurvy, and cannibalism. None of these three afflicted this expedition. He held the expedition together very well. He was a very strong leader. He was also he was a great writer. And this is one of the things that drew me to this story, is that even in the midst of all this travail as they're hauling these boats over the ice cap, he's writing in his journal these beautiful entries. And there's so much understatement in it. It's like they're struggling, they're slaughtering their last dogs, they're suffering from frostbite and starvation. And he'll say something like, "We're in for a time today."
Right.
And he'll keep saying, "Nil desperandum, nil desperandum, never despair." This was his rallying cry, and it got them all the way to open water, where they put these small boats into the open water and set sail for Siberia.
These have got to be some of the toughest men who ever lived. I mean, when you think about what they suffered physically.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of an American Shackleton story.
Without polar fleece and high-tech boots.
No GPS, nothing, no wicking clothing. It's they're wearing these heavy, saturated, sour-smelling pelts, and they're struggling. They're starving, slowly but surely. But as they head over the ice cap there, they're hunting constantly for food. So they'll shoot a walrus, they'll shoot a polar bear. They discover some islands along the way, which are still to this day known as the DeLong Islands, north of Siberia, part of Russia now. And yeah, I mean, they're not complaining. What's amazing, that runs through all the diaries and the journals, is just how little they complained for what was some of the most excruciating effort and striving that I think, you know, in the annals of exploration.
We're talking to Hampton Sides about his new book, In the Kingdom of Ice. Now, your books, and this book in particular, are so vivid. You feel like you're there with these characters in these landscapes. What voyages of your own did you take to write this book?
Well, I wanted to go to Russia, and the timing was perfect because the end of the Cold War and the thinning of the ice brought about by climate change has made it possible to go to these places relatively easily. I say relatively because it's still enormously expensive, and you had to have 10 or 12 permits, and it wasn't easy to get to Wrangel Island, the Russian side of the Bering Strait, and also the Lena River, the delta of the Lena River, which is one of the great rivers of the world that empties into the Arctic Ocean on the central coast of Siberia. So I wanted to see this landscape to try to, you know, get a feel for what it was like for these guys. I always try to do that with my books. That's kind of the fun and joy of writing narrative history, is to see what these landscapes look like, describe the weather and the bugs and the polar bear. And in this case, I saw 40 polar bear up there. I was on a Russian icebreaker going to this island called Wrangel, which figures prominently in the story. It's a place where John Muir was one of the first people to land in a vessel that was looking for the lost Jeanette. And on that voyage, we saw 40 polar bear out on the ice. So it was, you know, that's the fun part of doing these books, is physically going to these places.
Let's talk for a moment about James Gordon Bennett Jr. He was the newspaper owner and plays an interesting role in this story. It's this whole world in which newspaper men were not just reporting the news, but creating the news.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He was accused sometimes of being a stunt journalist, that he would create these situations that would produce endless amounts of copy, not just cover, politics or whatever. He had sent Stanley to find Livingston and had such an enormous success with that series of dispatches that he decided to bankroll this entire expedition. But he was an interesting cat in so many ways. Bennett was spoiled rotten. He was a reckless but very successful sailor. He won the first transatlantic yacht race. He brought tennis, competitive tennis, to the United States. He brought polo to the United States. He created a balloon race, which exists to this day, the Gordon Bennett Cup. Car racing, later when cars came into being, he created a car race. So he was into sports. He was into spectacle. He was into adventure. And all of this played into the Jeannette expedition. This is the way he saw it. It's like, well, they'll just smash through the ice and bag the pole for the United States and for the New York Herald and leave a copy of the New York Herald at the North Pole, and it'll all be just a great adventure, you know. And that's the way he viewed things. And he ran his newspaper. He was an exile. He ran his newspaper from Paris. And although he was a micromanager, he issued all his commands via the transatlantic cable, which was an enormously expensive thing to do. But he was an exile because he had, at a party in a New York salon, he had urinated in a grand piano in front of all the people and was ostracized and was flogged in the streets for this. And
in front of his fiancée.
Yes,
his fiancée and family.
Who broke off the engagement. And he was flogged for this, and then he got into a duel, and after the duel he said, I'm done with the United States, I'm moving to Paris. And he later created the Paris Herald, which then became the International Herald Tribune, which was a great newspaper. And I went to the International Herald Tribune offices in Paris to look at the Bennett files. And you can't invent a better character than James Gordon Bennett Jr. as an emblematic character of the Gilded Age.
So his interest in doing this was to have a great story.
Yeah. He wanted a great story. And
he bankrolled the Jeannette.
He paid for everything. It's the USS Jeannette. It was a Navy vessel sailing under Navy rules with naval commanders and officers. But he paid for the reinforcement of the ship. He paid for all the supplies. He paid for all the vessels that were sent afterwards to look for it when it became lost. And you could say, well, this is selfless of him, but in fact, he got amazing amounts of copy out of this. And it was even a bigger sensation in its day than the Stanley Livingston story. Just reams and reams of stories that came out of the Jeannette expedition. So he got his payback for this adventure.
There's also a tremendous amount of hubris in it. Basically, he's taking huge risks with other people's lives.
Yes. Well, there is that aspect of it. It's like, what could be better than to die for science or for a great adventure like this? This is kind of the way he viewed it, because this is the way he was in his own life with his own sailing exploits. He was also into this thing, this coach racing thing that he would do in Manhattan and also in Paris, where he would go out at midnight nude. Coach racing was a sport, basically, and he would go around, and I mean, he nearly died many times doing this. So he just viewed like if I'm willing to take these risks for my own sporting adventures, why shouldn't these guys? And of course, he was playing with these guys' lives, and their loved ones were, you know, at home waiting for them to return, and he didn't seem to particularly care one way or the other. It was a good story, and heck, I'm paying for it, so what's the big deal?
What's extraordinary to me, among other things, everything about this story is extraordinary, but that all of this source material that you worked with to write this book, letters, ship's logs, diaries, and so on, survived. I mean, the ship has sunk.
Right.
And they're going huge distances carrying these documents.
Yeah, yeah. One of the reasons that the Jeannette is not as well known as I think it should be is because all the photographs that were taken during the expedition went down with the ship, leaving only these logbooks and journals and diaries that you mentioned. They're really heavy, folio-sized books in many cases. They weigh a lot, and you know, when you're going 1,000 miles over the ice cap lugging these things, at many times the Jeannette commander, DeLong, was saying, we should just ditch this stuff. It's a waste of calories, essentially. But he knew that if he didn't have these logbooks and journals, the expedition would essentially die with it, and there would be no record of it. So he viewed them as relics that were inordinately important. And when he finally did cross the open water to Siberia and started wandering in this labyrinth called the Liana Delta. At a certain point, he decided that he had to bury them and catch them in the sand. And he did that. And after their ordeal, and I'm not going to say exactly what happens other than of the 33 men, 13 make it home. But the Navy undertakes a search to find those records. And miraculously, they do find them. They unbury them and bring them back by horse team and reindeer team, and then ultimately train all the way to Moscow, and then by steamer to New York, and then finally they end up in the National Archives, where they gather dust for 135 years. And what's interesting is that a lot of these logbooks were just meticulous measurements of the ice, the condition of the ice, the thickness of the ice, salinity, direction, and a lot of this stuff, when I was looking at this data, I was going, oh, this is useless data, really. I mean, it's such an unfortunate thing that they had to take these measurements five, six, seven times a day, every day, for 2 years as they were in the ice. But it turns out that NOAA scientists now are studying this data and using it as a benchmark for understanding how the ice has changed over the last century. And all this data is proving to be unbelievably useful in documenting how quickly the ice is deteriorated.
So their suffering was not for naught.
Not for naught. No, you know, that's the logbooks. The journals speak for themselves. They're beautiful. They're fascinating. It's a great document of human striving and leadership and just how they got through this ordeal. Not only that, but the survivors, some of them wrote what became best-selling books. There was a naval inquiry. There was a congressional inquiry, all of which produced an enormous amount of testimony. So, you know, when I'm doing these books, I really like to find it's important to have this mother load of primary material. And luckily, this expedition generated a lot of that kind of material.
The passion for, as your title calls it, the kingdom of ice is called pagophilia.
Oh, yeah. Well,
I learned that from reading your book.
Yeah, yeah. I think these ice people, pagophile is apparently someone who, or a creature, that is happiest in ice. And DeLong was certainly one of those guys. He had been to Greenland before this expedition, didn't think he had any particular interest in the Arctic, but he fell in love with it. It's something about the atmospheric conditions, the grandeur of this wilderness, what it does to sound, this enormous puzzle that they were trying to solve, what was up there. It was addictive. And a lot of the guys on the expedition had been in the Arctic before and had seen incredible hardships, as you almost invariably do in the Arctic, but they kept wanting to go back. It was just one of these addictions that they couldn't shake.
It's such a strange thing. It's hard to understand. I mean, I guess any passion is just what it is, but something as unlikely as the deep desire to go into an environment that is probably going to kill you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, and they know it.
Yeah.
And they know it. It's just that you read the annals of polar exploration. It's like missing vessels, you know, cannibalism, frostbite, just horrible, horrible conditions, madness. And yet these guys keep wanting to go back. That also says something about the times in the sense that these men were the generation just after the Civil War. And their brothers and uncles and fathers had fought in this great conflict. They had just missed it. And this was kind of a quasi-military thing. To do something great for your nation and for your Navy or for your Army, but to do it in the name of exploration and discovery. So that was part of the appeal, is to sort of test their manhood in some way that approximated what their family members had gone through with the Civil War.
Very interesting. It's also very much of a guy thing, if I may say so.
Yeah, I mean, this is very much a guy story, but one of the main characters of the book, to my surprise, became a woman. This came about because, this is, you know, I think historians dream of this situation that rarely happens, which is get a phone call from a little old lady who has rescued a trunk full of old letters from an attic. And would you like it? Because I'm going to throw it away. It happened in this case. It's nothing like this has ever happened to me before. I was immediately on a plane to Connecticut to meet this woman. It's Catherine DeLong, who's a distant relative of George DeLong. And the papers that she had were the papers of Emma DeLong, who was George DeLong's wife, who proved to be a wonderful writer, who was very closely and, you know, intimately involved in the expedition. who had sailed with George DeLong from Le Havre, France, all the way around the Horn to San Francisco, and knew all the intimate details of the expedition. And she wrote these amazing letters to DeLong as the expedition went off. She called them letters to nowhere, because she sent them into the Arctic with whaling vessels, hoping somehow, some way, they would reach him. They never did, but they are so eloquent and so passionate and gut-wrenching near the end, and it really became a love story as much as an adventure story. After the expedition, she lived with this thing for the rest of her life. She lived to be in her 90s, and when she died, I guess these papers ended up in an attic somewhere and passed down through the family and came to me. So I feel like it's a really important aspect of the book is Emma DeLong and her letters.
Very much so, a kind of strange punctuation of this horrifying adventure and then newsy bits about the Christmas tree and the love that was in that. It's very poignant. Has there been, or do you think there will ever be, any attempt to find the sunken ship?
Well, this is something that I actually have been curious about. I wrote a story for National Geographic a couple years ago about the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. And while doing that, I talked to Navy scientists who have submersibles and who do locate ships. We know the exact coordinates of where the Jeannette sank. It's in Russian waters off the DeLong Islands, as they're still called. Some question about whether the underside of the ice cap could have destroyed the ship because it's fairly shallow water. But there's a good chance that it is intact. It's extremely cold water, which is a good thing. So, unfortunately, our relationship with Russia has changed a lot since I started doing this book. Since Putin's incursion into Crimea, it's much more difficult to undertake expeditions and work with the Russians on these things. So, right now, it's not a good time. But I'm hoping that if this book does well and people become more and more interested in this Jeannette story, that there will be a wellspring of interest in finding the vessel and maybe pulling up some of the objects that were in the hull of that ship. One of the most interesting things was Edison. Edison had just begun to perfect the incandescent light bulb and a dynamo to power lights, and DeLong had brought lights with him on this expedition, hoping to light up the Arctic night. Unfortunately, they didn't quite work. Even as the expedition was locked in the ice, Edison in New Jersey in his lab finally did perfect the light bulb. So he just missed that by about 6 months or so. But that'd be one thing that would be interesting to pull up from the hull of that ship.
Hampton Sides' new book is called In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. Hampton, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Great pleasure.